From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as Michigan prepares to release its latest list of failing schools, for those who've been in the bottom 5%, it could be three strikes and you're out.
There's an axe hanging over their head. They could very, very well close.
University of Michigan's president on the urgency of the school's diversity plan.
You know, our need to improve the quality of the experience for all our students doesn't begin in 5 years, it begins yesterday.
A made in Michigan comedy film about a Jewish grandma and her pickle recipe, a metaphor for life.
The people who are around us, the people who care for us and nourish us and take care of us through our lives and love us, they're part of who we are, and they always stay with us. And they're ingredients in who we become as people.
Those stories and much more today, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How do we address racial tensions on a university campus?
Many of our students of color don't always feel as if they're fully welcomed, included members of our community.
Later in the program, what the University of Michigan is doing to address diversity, equity, and inclusion. But first, the latest list of Michigan's worst-performing schools will be released any day now. Under state law, the school reform office can close schools that have been mired in that lowest 5% for three straight years. But what of schools that say, wait, we're turning things around? Or schools in challenged neighborhoods where students started very far behind? And what happens to those students if the state shuts down their school? Erin Einhorn looked at one example of this dilemma in her report for Chalkbeat Detroit, and she's with us via Skype. This is a charter school in Detroit called the Michigan Technical Academy, MTA, and it's asking the state, please give us more time. Erin, tell us more about the MTA.
This is a school in Northwest Detroit that has been struggling for many years. They've had very low test scores. They've been on the priority list, the bottom 5% of schools, for 3 years already, and there's a fairly decent chance they'll be on the list, the 2016 list that's going to be coming out in the next couple of weeks. And especially in Detroit, where the stakes are actually quite a bit higher than in the rest of the state because of the legislation, the DPS legislation that passed last spring, that puts the school in danger, really. There's an axe hanging over their head. They could very, very well close. But when I visited the school, I found that actually the test scores aren't telling the whole story.
What do they tell you is behind these poor scores?
Well, the scores were, the school was struggling. And so several of the years of the bad scores were, you know, legitimately a sign of a serious problem in that school. The scores were so low, in fact, that Central Michigan University, which authorizes the charter for that school, a couple of years ago looked into actually shutting the school down, thinking this is kind of a lost cause. These children deserve better opportunities than the school is able to give them. And they looked at possibly closing the school down. But when they looked at the surrounding schools in the neighborhood, they found that a lot of the other options weren't a lot better. So they decided to, instead of closing the school, they decided to change it. So they brought in a new school board. They brought in a new principal, a new management company that had a new, a computer program, a computer system that enables teachers to tailor education to the specific needs of individual children. And folks in the school are saying that that things seem to be changing, that there's a positive culture that's making a big difference. And they're really starting to see some positive signs that the school's improving. Unfortunately, however, the test scores say what they say.
How long has the new approach with the new program for teachers and the new principal, how long has that been in effect and what are they seeing?
So it's really just been a year. The new principal took over in September of 2015, so they've had 1 year of track record with the new system. There was an MSTEP test given last spring, and you might think, oh, it's a new school, they're doing better. The MSTEP scores from last spring should reflect that. But that's actually not how MSTEP scores work. They're not designed to show progress of individual students. So the MSTEP will test grade level proficiency. So it gives a fourth grader a fourth grade test, and the fourth grader either passes it or the fourth grader doesn't.
So it doesn't measure whether that child has been behind to begin with and has been doing a great job of catching up.
Exactly. So if a fourth grader starts the year doing first grade work, and by springtime is doing third grade work, the teacher would say, wow, this student's doing really well. This student's really showing progress. But when the fourth grader who's doing third grade work now, it takes the fourth grade test, he or she is going to fail it. And it's going to look like that school isn't doing anything. So it's actually going to take a couple of years of a school that's doing the right things for the test scores in a school where students start out really far behind. It takes a few years for that to demonstrate itself in the MSTEP scores.
So that's what we're, as your story for Chalkbeat Detroit about the Michigan Technical Academy, they're trying to say, hey, give us some time under this whole new approach to really try to hit that. We're seeing progress. And we certainly know there's been a lot of dispute for the school district, the new one in Detroit, the Detroit Community Public Schools, whether they deserve a chance for that fresh start on the three-year countdown. Governor Snyder says they do. Attorney General Schuette says, nope, they do not. So where do we go from here? I mean, if you shut down these low 5%, you know, these 5% in the bottom for 3 years schools, then what? What happens to those students?
I don't think that's clear, and I don't really think that's been answered, certainly by the legislation that passed last spring, which says bad schools got to go. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. Sure, that makes a lot of sense. Bad schools are bad. Let's get rid of them, and let's put kids into better schools where they can have a better shot at success in life. And I think in concept, that's a beautiful idea. The question is...
But in what about in practical reality?
Well, the question is, where is that better school, right? So if you have two schools in a neighborhood and one of them is fantastic and one of them is horrible and the fantastic school has room for extra kids, let's move the kids from the bad school to the good school. And that's fantastic. That's great. Everybody wins. But in a lot of neighborhoods, including the neighborhood where the Michigan Technical Academy is located, most of the schools are low performing. So, you know, maybe there's a school that's in the bottom 5% and the one next to it's in, you know, in the 7th or 8th or 9th percent, you know, but you're going to move a bunch of kids who are way below grade level into that 7, 8, 9% school. And next year, by definition, if you get rid of the bottom 5%, the next, you know, the next chunk is also going to be the bottom 5%. The state is actually working on a letter grade system that I think a lot of people are hoping might have some more sophistication in it that might identify, you know, separate schools that are truly, you know, mired in failure, truly showing bad performance year after year with no sign of change from schools that are on the move. And I think a better system like that would benefit a lot of schools, but, you know, that's at least a year, probably 2 or 3 years out.
And here we have the list coming out very soon, this week, next week, sometime very soon. And so what options would a school like the MTA, the Michigan Technical Academy, have to stay open? If they're on that list again, what options do they have?
For schools, so the rules are a little bit different for schools in the city of Detroit and Michigan schools that are outside the city. So the school reform office has a little bit more discretion outside of the city. In the city of Detroit, the legislation that passed last spring that was designed to keep DPS out of bankruptcy included language that requires the state to shut down schools that have been on this bottom five list for 3 years in a row, you know, at least until there's a letter grade system that might be more sophisticated. But under this old system, with the bottom five list, 3 years on the bottom five list, they must close, with the only exception being schools that are where there's an unreasonable hardship for the students who attend. So if the state looks at that school and says taking students, you know, closing the school down would represent an unreasonable hardship to students, the school could stay open.
When we say unreasonable hardship, meaning they'd have to travel so far to get to any school? I mean, what do they mean by unreasonable hardship?
You know, the law doesn't clearly define it, so it seems like it's a little bit of discretion for the school reform office to come up with what that means. But I would imagine it's looking at whether there's a viable alternative in the neighborhood that students could reasonably get to. You know, are the other schools in the neighborhood in good condition? You know, are the classrooms in working order? are there, do they have space? So if a student, if a school is much better, but it's full, that doesn't do a lot of good. So I think they're going to be looking at that. And I know, you know, when I talked to the school reform office folks over the summer about this, they said they had already started the process of evaluating where the struggling schools are and whether or not there's viable alternatives for the students who attend them.
Aaron Chalkbeat, Detroit is relatively new to the education reporting scene. Tell us about the work you're doing there and what you want to do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Chalkbeat Detroit, or Chalkbeat, is a nonprofit education policy news site that's currently covering the schools in New York, Denver, Memphis, and Indianapolis. And last spring, we launched a pilot in Detroit to try to see whether there was a way we could bring this kind of in-depth, in-context reporting about schools to Detroit and to Michigan and cover the schools. And hopefully we still haven't launched formally, but we do hope to do so in the next few months.
Aaron Einhorn, who is covering education for Chalkbeat Detroit. Thank you for talking with us, Aaron.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up next, a heartwarming, gentle Made in Michigan comedy film about a Jewish grandma and her pickle recipe. It's a metaphor for life.
The people who are around us, the people who care for us and nourish us and take care of us through our lives and love us, they're part of who we are, and they always stay with us. And they're ingredients in who we become as people.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Pickle Recipe is a film completely shot in and around Detroit, but it's a film packed with universal truths. Truth about family ties, about family members who make us crazy and warm our hearts, sometimes at the very same moment, about the power of food and memories. All of that and more is wrapped up in this gentle comedy, which opens November 4th. Michael Manasseri is director of the film. It's so good to have you here, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
And we welcome co-writer and producer Sheldon Cohn with us to talk about his first feature film. Good to have you here, Sheldon.
Thank you very much.
I have to start with full disclosure for everybody. I just loved everything about this film. You have perfect cast. You have wonderful cinematography that really, really shows Detroit. You've got music, the story of family. I just thought there was so much heart and so much humor to The Pickle Recipe. So I'm starting right there with the fact that I really enjoyed this film. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I don't know if you know the backstory of the film.
Well, that's what I want to get into.
Okay.
So where did this idea come from?
This idea came from my partner, Gary Wolfson, and I, who were partners at Donor Advertising for 30 years. Went around the world making TV commercials, and we'd always talked about making a movie. He was a creative director, art director, and we'd brainstorm all the time. And we were at his house one night about 5 years ago. And at the end of the night, he said, you know, my grandma had this pickle recipe that my sister would kill for. And unfortunately, she was from Eastern Europe, and she made these amazing pickles, and she died before she ever passed it down. And they're gone forever. His family tried to recreate it, but it never worked out. So
there's the kernel.
That's the kernel. And we started talking. He said, you know, maybe that's a funny idea for a movie that, you know, could work out. And after some discussion, I met with Michael and said, hey, Michael, because I had known Michael from some projects, and said, Michael, what do you think about this? And Michael?
I basically said, I think that's a funny idea. I think it's a funny idea. I love that there's a grain of truth. I love the connection with food and family and grandparents. And the other thing, I mean, Sheldon and I have been talking for a while as well about films. And I had come in from California. I moved here because of the Michigan Film Incentive, which we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But Sheldon had expressed a great interest in making films, and he had really wonderful ideas. The great thing about this idea for us also was I could see us making this in Michigan. I can see us retaining creative control over this because I know that it was very important for Sheldon and Gary being commercial producers for so long. They were always on sets. They were always a part of the process. Mm-hmm. And I knew they wanted, I knew in their first film, they wanted to have that experience.
They didn't want to just turn in a script and then leave it to the gods.
Exactly.
There's no way that was going to happen.
And it gets, and the idea that it's going to be made in Michigan, that you're going to stay right in Southeast Michigan to draw from the talent pool and also for the location, because the city of Detroit is a great character in this film.
Yes, it is.
And I know your director of cinematography is from, in fact, I think a U of M grad.
He is a U of M grad. I hired him pretty much straight out of U of M when I first came here and did a project after the incentive started. and we've been working together ever since.
Shout out to Jeff George.
Jeff George, who's been also living in Detroit for since he got out of Ann Arbor, I mean, 6-7 years ago.
Well, it's clear because it just really shows the city. It isn't some of the productions that have happened in Michigan, there's a few shots and then they're gone and shooting elsewhere. There is a real true sense of Detroit. But let's go back. Start, Michael, by telling us who's Joey Miller and why does he need Grandma Rose's famous pickle recipe?
So Joey Miller is one of the hottest party MCs in Detroit. And basically he's working, doing one of his one-of-a-kind wedding routine in the beginning of the film. And there's a freak accident. And something for Joey, something terrible happens and everything. All his equipment gets destroyed. And his daughter, her bat mitzvah is coming up in 6 weeks. And he wants to do anything he can so he can perform at her bat mitzvah, at her party. And unfortunately, you find out he's a single dad. He's deep in debt. No one's going to give him any money. So he turns to his shameless Uncle Morty, played by Academy Award nominee David Paymer, who's been in almost every movie under the sun. And Morty says, okay, listen, I'm going to give you the money, but first you got to go steal your Grandma Rose's secret dill pickle recipe.
Oh, with that then, let's listen to a clip. This is a scene early in the film between actor John Doerr as Joey, great Canadian actor and comic. So he's hard up for cash. He needs to buy some new equipment so he can DJ at his daughter's bat mitzvah. And then here's Uncle Morty, who just might be able to help Joey with money if Joey can get a hold of Grandma Rose's pickle recipe.
Oh, I got it. No worries. Yeah. You want me to get it from her? I'll ask her for it.
Yeah, well, no, you can't ask for it. She'll never give it to you. No, she's at the deli all the time. You got to go there, and you got to somehow obtain it. You know, you got to, like, borrow it from her for a while.
Okay. Morty, if she doesn't want to give it out, it's her right. It's her recipe.
No, it's not just hers. It belongs to me, too. I mean, it, you know, it belongs to everybody.
Yeah, it sounds like stealing. I'm not going to steal from my own grandmother.
Kid, the clock is ticking. Do you want to be standing out there and watch them put her into a hole and then watch the pickle recipe go into the hole with her? Those pickles, they're just too damn good. Do me a favor. Think about it.
That is a clip from The Pickle Recipe as I talk with co-writer and producer Sheldon Cohn and director Michael Manasseri. And I've got to say, I think every family has that one family recipe that pushes everybody's emotional buttons. In our family, it was sugar cookies that my great uncle William Clare came off the farm in Guelph, Ontario, came to Detroit, and was an engineer who worked at the Michigan Central building. And no one has ever been able to replicate his sugar cookies. And it does. It pushes those emotional buttons. And there is something very, very gentle and wonderful because it is a family theme. And Michael, I saw a quote somewhere that you felt that Grandma Rose's pickle recipe is really a metaphor for life. How so?
Basically, there's a line in our film near the end of the film when our main character is realizing what he's been missing in his life and the importance of family. And he talks about how when you're making pickles and how all the ingredients in the jar ferment this cucumber and turn it into something special, something wonderful, something it wasn't before. And it's a metaphor for life in terms of the people who are around us, the people who care for us and nourish us and take care of us through our lives and love us, they're part of who we are and they always stay with us. And they're ingredients in who we become as people and how we relate to people. And so for me, certainly the kindness of my grandmother and the recipes from her kitchen. And I think all of us, no matter what ethnicity, where we come from, if you're lucky enough to have loving grandparents who took care of you, and you can remember the smell of their kitchen. You can remember when you were 4, 5, 6 years old and dinners at grandma's house and what that meant around the food and the taste and the smells and the conversation. And also how you observed the rest of your family and what it meant to everyone. So that's where, and I appreciate you so much talking about the warmth of the film, the heart of the film, because that's the most important thing. Look, there are laugh out loud funny moments. This is a funny, fun film.
It is.
But it also touches your heart.
I have to say, your cast is absolutely perfect. And let us start with Lynn Cohen, who plays 85-year-old Grandma Rose. Now, you may not know her name, but you will know her face if you've seen The Hunger Games. She played Megs from Sex and the City movies and the TV series because she played Magda, the housekeeper. So many other roles. Was she your first and most important casting?
Yes. What happened with Lynn Cohen is one night I was watching YouTube, and I stumbled upon this film called The Last Days of Leni Riefenstahl. And Leni Riefenstahl, or Lenny, was Hitler's documentarian, and it was a short, and Lynn Cohen was in it. And she played her, and she used a German accent, and I said, oh my gosh, that's Rose. She's elderly, but she's beautiful as an elderly woman. And so I called Michael and Gary and said, Lynn Cohen, I found her. And this was like 3.5 years ago. Lynn Cohen was the first person that we sent the script to, and she absolutely loved it, which was such a blessing for us.
That is great. She is truly the heart of the movie.
She is the heart of the movie. And an interesting thing about that casting process also, she had one condition. She wanted to be in the movie, but she said, listen, my husband Ron is an actor.
And find him work.
and I want him. If you see the film, mm-hmm. there's a wonderful touching scene where she goes to visit an old friend at a senior home. And the man who plays Arnie with her in that scene is her husband, Ron.
Oh.
And it's one of the most touching scenes in the film.
It truly is. And John Doerr, a Canadian writer and actor, but he's done a lot of TV work, hasn't mm-hmm. he?
Yes. Yeah, he's been doing a ton of stuff on network television. And fortunately for us, I mean, his career star is rising.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a funny, funny guy.
It was clear as I poked around reading people's credits, you pulled a lot of the cast and a lot of the crew from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And the Michigan Film Incentives brought you here. And were you able to use the incentives to make this film? You were on the bubble?
We were on the bubble. Well, we were the third to last film to actually receive the incentive. So, because obviously before you even start filming, you have to go through the entire process, the application, everything needs to be vetted. So before we even started filming, we were awarded the incentive, not the money, because you get mm-hmm. that
after
far down the line.
Yeah.
But when we were actually shooting on set was the day that the legislature killed it. So that was a tough day.
Yeah. And what do you think, when you think of the people from Michigan that were making a living working on productions like The Pickle Recipe and so many others that came through that aren't happening now, what does it mean for these people? Are they having to relocate like to North Carolina where they do have film incentives? Or
most have relocated. Most have. And it's Georgia, it's California, it's New York, it's North Carolina, Louisiana.
Ontario.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there are... You know, I like to say I am a product of the Michigan Film Incentive. My family was here. I made films in Los Angeles, and I decided because of the incentive to come and make movies in Michigan because I thought, okay, I think I can make this work. And so fortunately, it worked out for me. I was able to establish a foundation, do a number of projects, you know, and now I can do commercials and short films and feature films and remain in the state. But it's not easy. It's not easy. And, you know, the film incentive for all the ups and downs – it did a fair amount of what it was supposed to do in terms of stemming the brain drain. People were staying. Graduates from U of M and State and Oakland University, where I actually have a partnership where I work with the film school there. I've worked with hundreds of kids out of OU, and many of them have, you know, we're staying around.
Yeah.
And unfortunately now, they have to face the situation where am I going to work? Where am I going to work? Where am I going to actually be able to do this job? So, listen, with everything that's going on in Detroit and all the wonderful, you know, activity going on in Detroit now, I think there's still a shot. So I'm hopeful.
Okay.
But I need to be hopeful.
Yes,
I mean, how else am I going to look at it? So my intent is to stay. My intent is to keep making movies here. And, some of my crew is still around. But here's the thing. They always want to come back. If you can create an opportunity here and say, hey, we're going to shoot this in Michigan, they come back because they want to be home.
Director Michael Manasseri, co-writer and producer Sheldon Cohn, congratulations. And thanks so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Pickle Recipe opens November 4th in select theaters. And you can find out more by going to thepicklerecipe.com. Detroit native and writer Francine J. Harris is out with her new book of poetry. It's called Play Dead. Writer John Freeman has this review.
When I'm reading Francine J. Harris's poetry, I'm not doing anything else. It is the insistence of the voice, the images as troubling as they are beautifully wrought, the way the ink drifts from the left margin with the weight of her words, the indelible shape this technique makes on the page that stays with the reader. Her newest collection, Play Dead, challenges us in the way that only the most daring poetry can. Harris's language is so direct, so stark, that the poetry remains accessible even as she experiments with form. Because many of the poems in this collection engage lyrical prose to get at timely philosophical concepts, it is tempting to lump Harris in with writers like Claudia Rankine and Maggie Nelson, whose innovations with hybrid forms have achieved both literary and commercial success in recent years. Play Dead stands alone, however, because of the genius of her linguistic play. Take the closing lines of the poem, Wounded the Sway It Aches. O street serenade, sing-songing, oh, don't be so mean in between the clearing and bus stop. The first holler I get, I might forstrip. Here, the unconventional rhetoric subverts the power of the male gaze and its accompanying catcalls. Where many contemporary poets exercise experiment for experiment's sake, Harris's experimentation is always grounded in purpose. Theme and argument catalyze poetic technique, in other words. The opening poem, In, begins with the couplet, "The body starts a wind when it gets broken into. At night, when the leaves can't sleep, the black bark is one eye open and the snap vine dozes with its thorn in reach." This couplet is arguably a microcosm of the entire book, given the themes of sexual assault and toxic misogyny that show up later. These pieces don't merely offer up laments for passive female victims, though. They seethe at times with righteous invective. As Harris writes in Please Don't Trance Your Rabbit, "There's nothing cute and not a toy to flip and won't wind up and doesn't kick back to say from the inside hit. Save from the inside terror." Here the rabbit, the preyed upon, is no longer cute, is nothing to toy with. Earlier, I said that the images in Play Dead are as troubling as they are beautifully wrought. In part, this is because Harris not only acknowledges our cultural predilection for misogyny and violence, but her verse holds up a mirror to the reader's part in this system. Take the poem In Case, which highlights how institutions like schools and hospitals fail our society's vulnerable. One punches thigh open, another writes script, pens, white gown, and white banner, and white sheet, and white cover, and dove, and white birch, and parchment, and white cinder, and slab brick. The insistence, again, embodied in the repetition. The teleological failure of institutions by virtue of their white maleness. This book is ultimately worthy of a study far more in depth than this short review, which is to say it is an important book. Reading Play Dead this autumn just might constitute a civic duty.
John Freeman publishes poetry under the name Cal Freeman. He's the author of the book Brother of Leaving and the chapbook Heard Among the Windbreak. His review of Play Dead by Francine J. Harris is part of our ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark. You can find his review at michiganradio.org. Still to come, U of M's president talks about diversity, equity, and inclusion on campus. And then the state's largest startup competition happens this week. We'll learn what winning the grand prize means for a new business. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. On September 26, students at the University of Michigan discovered hate flyers plastered in several buildings. One of the flyers called on Euro-Americans, and I'm quoting, to, quote, "be white and stop apologizing, living in fear, and denying your heritage." Another flyer spelled out racist reasons why white women should not date black men. University President Mark Schlissel responded by calling a community conversation to give people a place to express thoughts and feelings. But as we heard yesterday, not all students were satisfied with the response. Lauren Ward is a sophomore at the Ross School of Business. She says the flyers were a tipping point for black student activists.
That very same week, we had three deaths of unarmed black men that went completely unnoticed in class, that went unnoticed academically, with professors.
And ironically, those flyers were posted just before President Schlissel unveiled the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Strategic Plan. It's the result of a year's worth of work and discussions with students, faculty, and staff. Let's talk more now about how a university community can and should build diversity and tolerance, and how it should respond to the kinds of actions that make students of color feel that they are not welcomed on campus. President Mark Schlissel, it's good to have you back on Stateside.
It's great to be here, Cynthia.
President Schlissel, how did those flyers make you feel?
My initial emotion was anger and disappointment. Anger that within our community or perhaps outside the Michigan campus, there are people that seek to denigrate others based on their race. And I knew that there would be a reaction on campus. I was, personally hurt and hurt on behalf of our students.
And when you had the community conversation and students stood up and shared their thoughts and their experiences, what did you hear that really touched you or really surprised you?
Well, I think the biggest message is that students, we have 43,000 students on the Ann Arbor campus, and they experience their life at Michigan as students differently. And many of our students of color, in this instance our Black students, don't always feel as if they're fully welcomed, included members of our community. And when that happens, they lose their equal opportunity to learn and to benefit from this wonderful university education we provide.
Did that surprise you when you heard those stories?
To be honest, unfortunately, it's not the first time I've heard stories like this. And I've come to appreciate that the lived experience here on campus is different for every one of our students. I think, on average, our students have a fantastic educational and social experience at Michigan, but there are, subsets of students and on occasions that don't feel similarly valued and included. And I've heard, unfortunately, heard the story before.
In fact, one of the students who spoke at that conversation is Lauren Ward. She's a sophomore at the Ross School of Business, and she was here on Stateside talking about her feelings when the flyers went up, and she calls that a tipping point in a very, very tough week. Let's listen to part of what she said.
That very same week, we had three deaths of unarmed Black men that went completely unnoticed in class, that went unnoticed academically. And it kind of created this frustration with the disconnect that students had between academia and real life, because these are problems that affect students all the time.
President Schlissel, what do you think a university's role should be in acknowledging outside events like those police-related shootings and how they impact students?
Well, I think a university education always occurs in the context of what's going on in society. And amongst the most sort of impactful and emotional events that have been happening in recent years is what appears to be an alarming increase in the deaths of suspects at the hands of law enforcement, and often suspects of color. I think that this has had a cumulative effect. And it really should. It should make us take a step back and ask what's going on in our greater society. It's not entirely fair to say these events go unnoticed. They're noticed by all of us. They're read about in the newspapers. They're in the media. The frustration is that we don't seem to be able to get a handle on why this is happening, some societal agreement on how our citizens and other visitors to our country all needed to be treated equally and equitably, and how we can work together to live up to our highest ideals.
When you hear a student say it went unnoticed in class, as an educator, is that the place, for example, let's say in someone's accounting class, is that where that kind of conversation should happen? Or should there be a better way for students to get a sense that, yes, the university recognizes this and, yes, understands what it's doing to you?
Yeah, I think there isn't a general answer to your question. I think when there are events that are occurring in society that have tremendous psychological or emotional impact on all of us, and particularly on our students, it's important that we do talk about those events in class, outside of class. You point out a statistics or a math class which may not sound relevant to the events associated with a police shooting or racist posters posted on campus. But if thoughts and inferences, attempts at understanding the meaning of what's going on in the world are so in the front of our students' minds that it impedes their learning, then I think talking about it at least briefly in class is important. You know, you mentioned our rollout of a diversity, equity, and inclusion plan. You know, one of the things that's important to us is that our faculty develop the tools necessary to know how to best guide discussions of these very challenging emotional topics.
All of this comes after a year of discussions and groundwork on the new strategic plan for diversity, equity, and inclusion. What are the building blocks of the campus-wide plan? Can you spell it out for us?
Sure. The first is how to build a more inclusive campus environment where every member of our community has an equal opportunity to thrive and to benefit from the educational experience we're presenting, that our faculty and staff feel equally valued in the workplace and have similar opportunities for advancement and career fulfillment. The second is a demographic challenge, is how do we make the university community more representative of the full breadth of our society. And when we talk about diversity, it's just not just race and ethnicity, but it's socioeconomic diversity, gender and gender identity diversity, diversity of political thought, geographical diversity. So the richness of our society has to be captured in our campus in order for us to be an ideal learning community. And then the third major component is scholarship around issues of diversity and inclusion. But, you know, at our core, the faculty are researchers and teachers, and we want to be able to make a university contribution by helping us better understand the impact of diversity on education and on research.
That second building block of the campus-wide plan to recruit, retain, and develop a diverse community, have you got a sense of how Michigan's law banning affirmative action at admissions has affected the university's ability to diversify its student population?
Well, you know, cause and effect are always extremely difficult, but the demographics of our campus has changed in the years since Proposal 2 was passed. So you can make inference from that to be sure. It's very hard to prove. We are completely committed to make all of our actions within the confines of the law. You know, the citizens of Michigan have spoken. Personally, as an educator, I'm convinced, based on data and based on my lifelong experience, that there are talented students in every community across the state of Michigan, all around the country and the world. But it's up to us to develop the tools that let us identify students all in every niche within our state who are talented and willing to work hard that would benefit from and contribute to a Michigan education. And, you know, that's the way we're approaching things. We're reaching out deeply and broadly across the state of Michigan, and we want every student that wants to better themselves through education, is willing to work hard to improve themselves, then we want them to consider applying to Michigan, and we will look at them in a very holistic fashion, certainly within the confines of the law, to identify that kind of talent and to bring them here into our community.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel as we talk about the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Strategic Plan that has just been unveiled at the same time that there were issues with racist flyers that appeared on the campus at the University of Michigan. And so we're looking at this five-year plan with these core building blocks, but I'm wondering about the day-to-day interactions happening on campus right now. In fact, let's take a quick listen to University of Michigan sophomore Lauren Ward on this very question.
Does it count as bullying if you're saying rude comments to a black girl on her hair? Does it count as bullying if you're insulting a man named Muhammad because of his name?
So, President Schlissel, what do you hope could be done to affect immediate changes on campus? I mean, a five-year plan is something at which to point the ship, if you will, and aim at that goal. But what about right now?
Yeah, you know, there's been much discourse about calling a plan a five-year plan. You know, our need to improve the quality of the experience for all our students doesn't begin in 5 years. You know, it begins yesterday. So, you know, we've already begun to implement aspects of the plan. And the idea is to continuously improve, check how we're doing, and then make mid-course adjustments as we move forward. I am not at all naive enough to think that at the end of 5 years, inclusion and equity will no longer be a problem at the University of Michigan. And I'm not naive to think it won't continue to exist in society at large. But as you mentioned, you know, we point ourselves in a direction using a strategic plan. We use the community building aspects of developing a plan to get the community focused in a direction and to be pulling all in that same direction. You know, the kind of examples that the student points out are, of course, you know, sort of intolerable modes of mistreatment among people. And I think if you walked around the Michigan campus and asked people how acceptable that kind of behavior is, you'd be hard-pressed to find an individual that stood up and said, boy, that's the way we should be behaving. I think a lot of what we're doing is raising people's consciousness and sensitivity to how others in the community may perceive the way they talk or behave, either intentionally or unintentionally. The act of developing the plan actually was the beginning of progress of the plan. We devolved this planning process to touch all of our units across campus. So, you know, usually when a university wants to develop a strategic plan, it picks a selective committee that should be broadly representative, locks them up in a room, has them meet 10 or 12 times, and then issue a report. What we did here was we assigned responsibility for the development of the plan to every major unit across the whole campus. So all 19 of our schools and colleges were responsible for coming up with plans, as well as all the major administrative and auxiliary units on the campus. And the idea behind that was to get a sense of sort of ownership at the very local level of what it was we were trying to accomplish and the tools and the pathways we wanted to take to get there. It's those conversations that are provoked when you put people to the task of asking, who do we want to be? How do we want to treat one another? What does every individual member of our community deserve to experience? That's the beginning of the process of improving the nature of our community.
Can I ask President Schlissel, have the people who put those flyers up been identified?
No, we have absolutely no idea who put the flyers up. We don't know whether it's, you know, one or two people or 20 people. We don't know whether they're members of our community, you know, students or faculty or staff, or whether they're completely outside the university. You know, we do know that the sentiments expressed in those flyers are antithetical to the values of the University of Michigan community. I think it's very important that we confront this kind of hateful speech with more speech, you know, with students and others stepping up as allies, supporting one another, and letting the community as a whole know that whoever it was that put these flyers up weren't speaking for us. You know, they were speaking for hate.
University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on Stateside.
Well, thanks so much, Cynthia, for your interest.
This Thursday, 36 Michigan startup companies will compete for up to $1 million in prizes and critical exposure to venture capital investors, both regional and national. It's the 7th annual Accelerate Michigan Innovation Competition. Organizers say this competition with the prize winners have created over 1,000 jobs and raised over $500 million in venture capital. Danny Ellis is the CEO of SkySpecs. His company won $500,000, the grand prize, in the 2014 Accelerate Michigan competition. Danny, tell us what your business does.
Yeah, so at SkySpecs, we develop software to automate drones for large structural inspection. We've been focusing on the wind turbine market for many years now, and that's our primary focus. So we deploy these drones to go get visual imagery of wind turbines instead of having to send humans to do it.
And what did winning that $500,000 grand prize mean for your business?
Well, it was at the absolute perfect time. We had previously raised a small seed fund, and then at the time we had just started a TechStars program out in New York City. And so we had temporarily moved our team to New York, knowing we were going to come back to Michigan when it was done. But we were simultaneously trying to raise another round of funding, you know, to keep us going and to hire some more engineers. So the Accelerate Michigan funding actually, you know, got us another entire year to work and to improve our business before we could actually take its customers.
Now, being in New York City, it's one of the premier startup incubators in the nation there at TechStars. Did you consider staying there, or, you know, what brought you back to Michigan?
No, right from the beginning, we knew we were not going to stay there. Even before we stepped foot in Manhattan, we knew the goal was to come back. You know, a lot of us were born and raised in Michigan, and even the ones that weren't came here for school at the University of Michigan. And so Ann Arbor is very near and dear to our hearts, and you know, we really knew that this was the right place to have a business. And really, operating drones in the middle of Manhattan isn't very easy or feasible, so it wasn't good for any of our outdoor testing.
Good point, good point. Danny, competitions like Accelerate Michigan and incubators like Spark in Ann Arbor or Start Garden in Grand Rapids, Tech Town in Detroit, along with venture capital firms and angel investors. All of these are important ingredients for a healthy ecosystem to grow ideas and grow new businesses. So as you've been building SkySpecs, I'm wondering, what do you see that Michigan is missing that could help other startups get off the ground and keep companies in this state?
I would actually say we're not really missing anything. I think you actually have all the right resources here in the state, and it really just comes down to perception, making sure that people understand those resources are here. And you know, in a lot of ways, those resources are they go a lot further in Michigan. You know, with the cost of living being so much more reasonable here, you don't have to raise nearly as much money to actually have a successful business.
Danny, what advice would you offer new entrepreneurs who think they've got an idea and it's a good one and they're just trying to get that business off the ground?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I have so much advice from everything that we've done. I mean, we founded the business straight out of school, so none of us really had any prior, you know, real world experience prior to doing this. But I would say that the first bit of advice is just simplify what you're trying to do. If you can find the simplest solution for a problem you're trying to solve and go test it quickly, I just can't reiterate that enough. We thought we were doing that, and we were still too complicated in the early days. Finally found a way to simplify everything, and it makes the whole process that much easier.
The Accelerate Michigan Innovation Competition is this Thursday at Cobo Convention Center in Detroit. You can get all the details by going to acceleratemichigan.org. Danny Ellis, CEO of SkySpecs, the 2014 grand prize winner. Thanks, Danny, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.